Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today retired from the sociology department at Chico State University and is author or editor of 18 books. Gail Kimball explores groups underrepresented in research, such as youth. She has traveled around the world to interview young people for her trilogy about global youth activism, young women, and how global youth viewpoints change our future. She was surprised, as she did the research for her books, how many scholars write about youth without actually talking to them. Gail Kimball, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Yes, I was stunned, because any other field, if you're talking about women, you include women's voices. If you're talking about Black Americans, you interview Black Americans. But there would be whole books by people, authors who are sympathetic with the youth position in this capitalist system, but they didn't talk to one, not one.
That is surprising.
Yes, it's ageism, and that's why I wrote the book Ageism and Youth Studies.
Yeah, well, you have so many books that this trilogy that I was referring to, you deal with subjects about age discrimination, would you call it, ageism, mm-hmm. Young women. And I was curious as to how you got off on this track, because your undergraduate work was in religious studies.
History.
And you then were a professor of sociology.
I've never taken a social class in my life. But I majored at Berkeley in history, and then got a master's at UCLA in history while I was teaching history in secondary school. And then I got bored with teaching U.S. history. A little bit of world history was fun. So I went to UCSB and got my master's and PhD in religious studies. So it's really all about intellectual history. So I'm interested in the ideas and thinking of youth, of women, of egalitarian couples, as you can see in my book list. So there's a certain sense to it.
And there is overlap from the topics that you mentioned, because also when you're at Chico State, you're involved with women's studies.
Yes.
So your varied background may seem disparate, but it really comes together with this work, that your recent work.
Yes. And as you said, it's all about people who aren't represented and aren't listened to, and me bringing their voices to the fore. So it's about hearing the voices of these large groups of people that have been neglected and ignored.
My guest is Gail Kimball, and she retired from Chico State University. She taught in the sociology department, and she was involved with women's studies there. And she now has a trilogy. And, for example, the title of Volume 1, Global Themes, Young Women's Global Revolution, Brave. Describe the cover of that book, Gail.
Okay, so this is an interesting story. The book title is Brave: Young Women's Global Revolution, and book one, the volume one, is about global themes, and volume two is about regions. So the cover of volume one is, I took a photograph in Tahrir Square in Cairo in 2011, and I was all by myself. That's a good story. It's kind of a scary story. Should I tell it?
Yes.
I met...
Because even the title of this book is Brave.
Yeah. And I was brave, definitely.
And I'm guessing that you went there by yourself.
I went to Egypt by myself, and I spent as much time as I could in the middle of Tahrir Square, where a big uprising was going on. And if people want to see it, I have some videos on my YouTube channel. So you just go to YouTube and Google Gail Kimball, and you'll see the demonstrators. But the scary story was that I thought I was going to be met at the airport by a woman who taught English. And we'd become friends when she was studying at Chico State, and she invited me to come to visit her. And I said, well, how do I get to your house? She said, no problem, I lift you. So I went to the airport. I waited 2 hours. No one was there to lift me.
So there you are.
In Cairo.
And I assume that your Arabic is limited.
It's zilch. I know Habibi, because the taxi driver was say calling me honey, which is Habibi, and hijab, you know, some headgear that women wear that I knew from my studies. So, no, and there people were coming in, the women totally veiled. It's kind of, it's a little disconcerting. And so then some kind policeman found a taxi driver who understood English, and I had her address. So that was harrowing because he kept trying to put his hand on my thigh. And I said, strangers don't touch strangers. Oh, Habibi, we're just being friendly.
So you're sitting in the front seat next to the driver, and he figures, oh, here's his chance.
Yes. And he invited me to come to his house and stay with him. But he did, and it was not easy, but we found this big row of apartment buildings, and they were like seven stories, and I would never have found her apartment because everything was in Arabic. And just as we drove up, this is beautiful synchronicity, she walked out, and she said, Gail, what are you doing here?
And this is 2011, and she probably, I don't know if she had a cell phone, and you don't have a cell phone, so you were totally incommunicado with this lady that was supposed to meet you.
But I think she had no intention of meeting me.
Oh.
Because what happened is when she was in Chico, she kind of bloomed and had some kind of independence and thoughts of her own. But when she came back to Cairo, she was totally, even though she was a teacher, a professional, she was totally under the thumb of her husband. And he, like she told me, I asked her, what are you going to do for your summer vacation? And she said, I don't know. My husband hasn't told me yet. And so he didn't want me there. And in fact, I stayed there for two nights and I never met him. And she said, just stay away from him. Da, 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 da. And so he told me to leave.
Well, there was a time when I taught English to men from Saudi Arabia. And if they were curious about, say, our politics, they would not say, well, teacher, what do you think? They would say, what does your husband think about that? And that was an interesting difference, that you don't ask a woman her opinion. You ask what her husband opinion is about that
like
subject.
Even in Saudi Arabia, your name would not be Nancy. It would be wife of or mother of, or you wouldn't even be called by your own name.
I must add, they were very polite and very nice, but they just were products of their culture.
Yeah, right.
My guest is Gail Kimble, and she has traveled all over the world doing research for her books, and she's just described what happened when she went to Tahrir Square in Cairo and took this picture that is used on the cover of one of her new books.
I really like it because it's a woman in hijab who is being a revolutionary, and behind her is the flag, and she has her fingers raised in the victory sign. In her hijab. So she's traditional in some ways, and then she's a rebel. And that's what I talked about in Brave, that the Muslim women are so courageous because they have so many obstacles to face. I interviewed a young woman who was a teenager, and she was at the forefront of the battles with the police in Tahrir Square, and she saw friends die. So it wasn't just like marching and protesting. It was battle. And she was there every day. She'd go to school, take her exams, and then go to the square. And it was also really brave for women to sleep in the square in tents. So if you look at my YouTube picture of some of the young protesters, you'll see that they're living in tents. And a woman does not sleep with mixed sex gathering in those countries, but they did, and it was accepted. So the interesting thing was that during the height of the uprising, the rebellion against President Mubarak, gender roles kind of went to the side. And so women helped, you know, break up cobblestones and throw stones at the police and were medics, and they were accepted. And the harassment that's so typical of Egypt stopped for a while, but then it resumed big time. In a terrible, terrible ways.
Well, you tell the story of this young woman pictured on your cover of your book, Brave, Young Women's Global Revolution. you tell her story, but were you able to talk to her directly, or did you get her story through some of the sources?
I don't know who the woman is in the cover. So she's, I have no idea who she is.
Okay.
But I told the story of some of the women that I interviewed who were in the square. And it was interesting because when you entered the square, they had it divided by men and women. So I had my bag searched and patted down and that kind of thing. And women who were veiled checked me, patted me down, checked my bag. So it was sex segregated in that way, but not in the square.
So you, as an English speaker, you had to rely on the skill of a young woman that you were interviewing, for example, that she had to speak English or somebody had to interpret for you. How
Correct.
Did you go about arranging these interviews?
A lot of times what I do is I just go someplace. So I'll just go to Istanbul where the uprisings were, or I'll go to Athens and talk to people. And in the Egyptian case, I just went to the square, found people, and sat down. And the college students interviewed a textile worker woman who was single and came by herself, who was very brave. And she said, I hear that in the West, women have very strong spirits. Why is that? And I gave her some explanations. But she was so brave to come and stay there in the square and not be married and to be a young, uneducated woman.
Did you take any recording equipment to record their voices, or did you just take notes?
I recorded. I had a little flip camera, so that's why I have some of the videos on YouTube.
So you got both the pictures and the voice?
Right, and then some people I Skyped with.
So you start out, this wasn't the first country you went to do your interviews?
No. I used to go to Japan a lot to teach energy tools, mind power workshops.
One of your earlier books.
Yeah. And so I knew people there who were my students. And one of my students in Japan, her father was a local official. And so he arranged for me to go to a high school, which otherwise I would never have been able to do, and talk to students, interview classes, and also have them fill out my questionnaire. So I have over 4,000 questionnaire responses from 88 countries.
Yeah, when I read those figures, it's staggering. Repeat that again, Gail.
I have over 4,000, actually 4,149 responses from 88 countries. And the neat thing about it is most of them are not from internet sources, because then that selects for middle class kids who have access to the internet. So I have ones from India where the teacher had to walk 3 miles up a hill to this remote school, and he got questionnaires for me. So there's questionnaires like that from around the world that are very heterogeneous.
So in that way, you were able to get responses from not just upper class kids who had...
I didn't want that.
But then how did you account for the fact that you wanted some that were not English speakers, I'm assuming?
Well,
so if they're filling out this survey, they have to fill it out in their own language.
Right. So either the teachers translated for me, or I found people who were French speakers or German speakers or whatever to translate for me. But an interesting story is in Pakistan, one of the young college students who answered my questionnaire, we became really good friends. And I said, I would like you to interview a village girl who's illiterate because I want to hear what her experience is. So he did. And that interview, the transcript is available. He translated it on my Global Youth Speak Out WordPress blog. So if anybody wants to read it, but it was so sad because she has no autonomy. When we interviewed her, she was 18, and her parents announced that they had a fiancé for her. And she knew very little about him. She didn't even know how old he was. And she had seen, they could see each other a couple times, but that was it. And she was very worried because, you know, the tradition in Middle Eastern countries Muslim countries is that you get a dowry, India, and that's like gold jewelry. So the bride should come with gold jewelry. And her parents were laborers. They made a few cents a day. They're not going to be able to buy her jewelry. So she was worried about whether that would jeopardize the engagement. So it was so moving. I said to Hassan, well, ask her if she wants to learn to read. And so she did. So I said, okay, let's start a school. And so the way we set it up is I raised money or gave money, and then he would go to the village because we didn't have a physical location. That would be too much money. He'd go to someone's home and teach. I found a curriculum in Urdu that was basic literacy, and he teach. So every once in a while, I get some extra money. He or a friend of his, a student, will teach another round of the 100-day introduction to reading and writing. Because in some Pakistani villages, there's a government school for boys, but there's no government school for girls. And some of the girls that he facilitated me Skyping with said that they didn't go to school because the teacher beat them with rulers or whatever. So they didn't want to go. So I wish I was a billionaire and could get that school going full time year round.
Were you able, because that's quite time consuming, this commitment, were you able to get a lot of it done from Chico? Or did you need to stay this school that you wanted to facilitate?
Oh, well, Hassan and other students did the teaching. So all I did was find the curriculum, the workbook that he could use, and raise money. So it wasn't that time-consuming, except money raising is always time-consuming.
My guest is sociologist Gail Kimball, and she has written a trilogy of books on global youth attitudes and activism. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Gail Kimball, who has researched global youth attitudes around the world, and she did surveys of over 4,000 young people from 88 countries. Gail, why don't you tell us the names of the three books in your trilogy?
Okay. I have Ageism and Youth Studies, which I mentioned, and I have Brave Young Women's Global Revolution. And I have another one about future, what youth values will mean for our future. And I forgot
Helping
what I even named
to
that.
Study.
And then I have
study
a fourth guide. Book, which is called Your Mindful Guide to Academic Success Beat Burnout. Because the reason I wrote that one...
Yeah, because that's a little off the subject of your other three books, the focus
except,
on youth.
Except that it's not really, because what happened when I was in India and China, those students, and North Korea, South Korea, those students were so burned out because they would study until 10 or 11 at night. All the time. They were burned out. So I thought, I need to write a guidebook for these people in India and North Korea and China where they're studying all the time so they have some kind of guidebook. And also, I always, if I'm writing about youth, include youth. So there's lots of youth experiences and advice in that guidebook.
Yeah, in fact, the title of that particular book, Your Mindful Guide to Academic Success, Beat Burnout. And I interviewed an author, in fact, just recently, that said that when he was in China, that he met this student who had come, she'd studied somewhere else, and that by the time she went into the system there, she was just a different person. She was just beat down, and she no longer was interested. They weren't interested in learning to read. And I was impressed that you said that young, that poor young lady that had could not read wanted to learn to read.
She said, "I can't even read the Quran." So she wanted most of all to be able to read that.
So,
oh, but I should tell you, her mother said, we started the school, and her mother said no, she couldn't go because the fiancé might not like her being out and about in the world.
Oh, so but that would have been another strike against her. First of all, if she didn't have a dowry, he might say no. And then if she had the nerve to want to educate herself, that was another strike against her.
Right. But the mother did send some little kids. One of her daughters and a male cousin. So she thought it was a good idea for the little kids, but not for a woman
that she wanted to marry off. That she wanted to marry off.
Yeah, because I think they have six sisters in that family, so that's expensive. She definitely would want to marry them off. Can I tell you another interesting story? One of the Pakistani women whose houses that's a royal way that Hassan taught. She had 8 children, and she was in her late 30s. And I asked her in a kind of fairly subtle way about birth control. And she said, oh, no, it's between the passion of the husband and the wife and Allah. So, and then her next baby was born, stillborn, because she had high blood pressure, was part of the contributing problem. But birth control, she didn't believe in. And some mullahs teach still in Pakistan not to use it.
Well, now, you've mentioned a few of the countries that you visited, and this is a huge commitment to this research, mm-hmm. Gail, to go all these various countries and try to bring out voices that we otherwise would not hear. I mean, what other researchers are going to go through what you put yourself through to really get the true story from these young people?
Well, I'll give listeners a little hint, is that if you use credit cards that have miles attached to them, you get a lot of free flights. So I flew from Bali to Shanghai for, I don't know, $50 or something. And I also look for airlines that'll let you stop off without charging you. So when I went to Cairo, I stopped off in Zurich, and I interviewed kids in schools there. So everything I buy on those credit cards, everything. So it's possible to use a card for. So it wasn't as expensive as it sounded.
Well, when you're interviewing these young people, I'm sure there are questions that are unique to that particular country and culture, but there must have been questions that you wanted to know the answers across the board, every young person that you talked to. What were some of those questions that you wanted to have answers to?
To me, the most interesting question was, if you could ask a question of the wisest person on the planet, what would you ask her or him? And because it's so open-ended. And that's another thing, is a lot of questionnaires of youth are multiple choice. So what if you have a feeling or a thought that's not A, B, C, or D? So all my questions are open-ended, and they're all the questions and the outcomes are on the Global Youth Speak Out WordPress site, which is, of course, anybody can go to.
I even wonder, particularly young women, if this is the first time anybody asked them what they thought about anything, because I would think their opinions weren't valued in many cultures.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Pakistan again, because I think that's particularly true there. And I asked the little kids in Skype sessions what they wanted to do for work. I mean, Hassan said the girls will probably be housewives, but they said only a few things: teacher or maybe health worker, but that was it. So they didn't have a wide range. So yeah, somebody had probably never asked them that. But one of the findings of the survey, the quantitative survey, is there hardly any differences between boys and girls. And so I think that's really interesting nowadays. And I think that's a unique characteristic of Generation Y and Z, is they're very comfortable with diversity, including gender. So they don't think because you're a woman, you're not as smart, because they know that in school, the girls do better. And that's around the world. There's more girls in university around the world now than boys. Not in Africa, but overall.
My guest is retired sociology professor Gail Kimble, and she has written or edited 18 books, but her recent work is with young people, and she has a couple of volumes on global themes, Young Women's Global Revolution, and the title of that book is Brave. And she takes a look at ageism in youth studies, and you say that, because you mentioned this generation. Maybe you should mention, for those of us who don't keep up with these young people, we've heard of millennials, but then now the millennials have gotten older. They're no longer the young people. So who are the young people now? How do you label their generation?
They're called Generation Z, and they're called homelanders. And all the descriptions that I've read about them are that, like Generation Y or the millennials, they're very obviously connected with technology. But what I'm reading is that Z also values face-to-face contact, individual mentoring. So it's kind of a reaction to Gen Y, as Gen Z wants that kind of human contact. But what I've learned from talking to high school students is how pressured they are to succeed, and maybe even girls more than boys. Because we know that in the U.S., girls have much higher rates of anxiety and depression than boys do, talking about teenagers. Mm-hmm. And media is part of it, because I think girls are socialized to respond more to negative critics on social media, or if you're not invited to a party or someone doesn't like your photo that you post on Instagram or something. So there's even more pressure on girls, and I think it results in that kind of anxiety. But they're expected to succeed and be good looking and be sexy and be popular and get great scores on the SAT so they can get into a good university, so they can have a good job. And they know they're going to have to pay off their huge college loans, so they really will need a good job, because the average college student averages about $30,000 in debt when they graduate. So they're pressured. They're really pressured.
Well, I had an interesting conversation recently with this young senior who has a very responsible job, and I guess I asked if he drove to this job. And he says, no, I don't have a car. And then he started talking about how he takes the bus. Well, I go down and I catch the bus here, and then I do this. And it was not, his attitude was like, oh, no, I got to take the bus. His eyes lit up like, yeah, here's how I do it. I catch the bus here, and then I go there. And I thought, boy, when I was growing up, you wanted to be able to drive. You couldn't wait to get your driver's license.
You got it at 16.
Yeah, absolutely. And here was a young man past the age he could have been driving himself around. And he didn't seem to have a desire for a car. The bus seemed perfectly adequate transportation around town here in Chico. And I thought, gosh, I'm out of touch with, I mean, I hear these things. I hear about them. But here was a real live young man who was excited about not feeling he had to have a car.
Right.
And I was reading that you mentioned this attitude of, you say that the generation we or me, and if millennials are narcissistic. And so that apparently is what some people of another generation think. Well, this millennials are narcissistic. What did you find?
I think a really interesting thing is one of the questions on the survey was, what's your life purpose? What's your meaning in life? And what they said is do good works was 30% of the people, make the world better.
30% of the people the young people you questioned.
The 4,000 young people from 88 countries. Yeah. And worship God, that was most often mentioned by Muslim youth, 15%, help family or country, 15%. 21% of them did say their life purpose was personal goals, like to be happy or to grow or to find love or something. So that, and also their career choices were really altruistic, to be health workers or teachers, that kind of thing. So what the survey shows is that they care about doing good for other people. If you're anxious and depressed, that does make you kind of self-centered, but that's different than being narcissistic because they care about other people. And
you found across the board in these 88 countries that you found similar responses to
this
question.
Yes, there are really, really very few differences in gender or age because I divided up into teens and younger people I called kids. So part of it, of course, is they're all the educated kids who are middle class are on the internet, so they use common slang, and you'll hear. I heard "hang out with my friends" a lot of places, or a translation of "hang out," or "something is cool," or whatever it is. So there's definitely a global educated youth culture.
My guest is Gail Kimble, and she has written a lot or edited 18 books, but her recent study, research, took her to 88. Well, did you go per? Not
no,
d-
no.
Excuse me. You didn't go to 88 countries,
no.
But your research involved responses from 88 countries.
Exactly.
And over 4,000 young people were responding to your surveys. And I would think that would be extremely interesting, but reading responses to 4,000.
The tedious part was tabulating them, because for the quantitative part, I put all the responses into categories. So that's why I can tell you that, you know, that for fun they like to do sports and hang out with their friends, because I gave codes to their written words.
Mm-hmm. So that's the way
that was a pain in the, you know,
yeah.
What.
Well, I would think it would be fascinating to read their responses,
mm-hmm.
But
the tabulating is not.
But then it gave you a fuller picture.
Well, I wanted to do both qualitative and quantitative research. So then, if I say my impression is this is a really altruistic, concerned about other people generation.
Then people can argue with your impression because you don't have any facts to back yourself
right,
up.
Right, but I can say this many answered this way in this question about their life purpose. But I think the other problem with narcissism is that if you take the test, it asks questions like, are you a good leader? So I would say yes. I don't think that means I'm narcissistic. It means that I have confidence in certain traits. So there's been criticism of the test for narcissism, that it really doesn't test that. Because, I mean, Trump is a beautiful example of a narcissist, right? You don't have to answer that. But those kind of unhealthy qualities, I don't think can be generalized to young people. People say they're apolitical, but it's not that they don't care. It's that they are disgusted with politics. So they don't want to identify with political parties or work with political parties. So they're working with other kinds of groups.
So you ask them about their values, and you also ask them about religious beliefs. And there was variation there.
Mm-hmm.
Muslim countries, for example, you said, and you ask them about God and their life purpose, you said, and I'm curious as to what they said with their life purpose. You said they were very willing to help people.
To
be altruistic?
Yeah. The good works things, they wanted to make the world better, because if they're at all educated, they know that there's a problem of poverty. They know there's a growing inequality. The ones who are educated know about climate change. The young people who aren't educated don't know about it. So they are aware of global issues, and they want to do something to make it better, right? And I would say China there, that was the most frequent place. I want to help my country. I want to help my family. Also India. So countries with long traditions of extended families and ancestral knowledge, they thought more about helping their families than, say, in North America. Or maybe kids in North America don't think about helping their families because their parents are better off than young people.
I'll be back with my guest, sociologist Gail Kimball, after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest surveyed youth all over the world to find out their attitudes on activism, young women, and their viewpoints. I have the impression that organized religion is kind of falling off the radar of young people, say, in France. But you did ask them about their participation in organized religion, and you got comments about Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Taoism, Islam, Judaism, and animism.
Mm-hmm.
And that must have been fascinating reading, to find their views about organized religion. What did you find?
That you're right, that their interest in spirituality is expressed through the religion that they're raised in. And in India, one of the ways that Hinduism manifested is the idea that your parents should select your mate. So a lot of the young women that I talked to said, yeah, I would like to select my own husband, but it's not going to happen. My parents are going to do it. And some said, oh, that's fine. I trust them. I think it's not just their beliefs that are different. It's the beliefs influence attitudes towards marriage and family and education and those kind of things.
Yeah, because.
But you know, it's so interesting because even in the Arab world now, there's more women that are educated. They're not employed at anywhere near the same amount as men. But their parents are sending their girls to college, if they can.
Well, you took a look at the traditional values in all these countries that you studied. And under this chapter 3, for example, in your book, Global Youth Values Transforming Our Future, the traditional values, you have chapter 3, traditional values, critics of modern values and stress, traditional rural versus modern urban values. And what did you find there, the difference in traditional rural versus modern urban values?
A lot of it has to do with individualism and collective values. So the modern contemporary values, which are more often found in educated urban people, are the individual is important and should succeed and strive, whereas traditional values, which are more often found in rural areas, are no, the individual is not what's important. It's your family. It's your community, your neighborhood. That's what's important, and it is that, and that you conform to the values. Dress can be an example of that. So, I know girls in India who will take jeans in their bag when they leave the village, and then they change into jeans later.
They wear their sari on top, and then when they're out of the view, put on the jeans. Well, you do have a section, respect for elders, and I would think that would vary a good bit. Say rural versus urban,
oh, yes.
Or from country to country.
Oh, yes, right. But, you know, the interesting thing about this generation, I would say globally, is that they like elders. Whereas in the 60s, the baby boomers said, don't trust anybody over 30. they're suspect. Don't hang with them. But this generation is perfectly comfortable with older people. And they can be friends. And you know, maybe part of that in the U.S. is a lot of young people have to live with their parents because they can't afford not to after college. So the emptiness gets filled again.
Well, still in this book, Global Youth Values Transforming Our Future, you have a chapter on the generation gap and the academics viewpoint. And you say a current generation gap, question mark. So what did you find? Because you are an academic yourself. So what did you find then?
The young people think there's a generation gap in terms of technology. That's around the world.
So it's not just us.
No, any young person that has access to a computer will tell you that their parents and grandparents look to them as the authority. So I know I talked with a principal, a high school principal in India, and he said, yeah, the young people are my teachers in terms of technology. So the youth don't respect elders in terms of their technological know-how, but they respect them as people and as friends and mentors.
My guest, Gail Kimball, has traveled all over the world researching the attitudes and the opinions of young people, and you have the global youth that you interviewed, that you asked them to fill out surveys for you, and then you have a couple of books, two volumes, on brave young women's global revolution. So you got information from a whole variety of countries, Latin mm-hmm. America, Africa, Muslim countries, Egypt we mentioned, Russia, China, India, all these countries in researching specifically young women.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when I was doing the research, I didn't separate it out. You know, I would ask everybody I could find, male or female, questions and interview them. But then I just took out the pertinent parts and added a lot of background in terms of young women's, the changes that are happening for them.
And we're familiar with the term sexism because that comes up a lot in your work. But ageism is not something that we typically even consider existing. And you have ageism in youth studies. And what did you learn there?
Well, when I used to think of ageism, I would think of it in terms of elder people in the workplace. So that's what was my
association. The other end of the lifespan, yeah, life
yes.
cycle.
But as I said, when I was doing all the background reading in terms of what other people had written in terms of youth studies, and I would, you know, look for everything I could possibly find, I kept looking for, okay, what do the young people have to say about this? The most I saw in terms of reaching for their input was these multiple choice questionnaires. And yeah, they were usually about health. Do you practice birth control? Do you smoke? Do you some kind of health-related issues, because those were funded by government agencies. But I don't know of any other survey that's open-ended that's interested in their attitudes and beliefs and values. But I think we need to know that in terms of planning for the future, because it's a truism to say it, but they are our future.
Well, in the process, in the course of asking them these questions, you discovered that, gosh, these kids need some help knowing how to study. So what did you, and I'm assuming that's why you came out with your book, Your Mindful Guide to Academic Success, and then Beat Burnout. And so that's kind of surprising that burnout was pretty pervasive.
Oh, yes. They're exhausted. I mean, everywhere, where any country where the kid is college bound, they're exhausted. And in the U.S., it's even worse because they're expected to work often and have school activities to put on their college application. Whereas in Asia, there would be no thought of the child working. You would just study. And you wouldn't have time. You just go to school. You go to tutorials afterwards, do homework, go to bed exhausted. So, Yeah, they're tired. And so one of the things that I wanted to include in the book was not just traditional how to study, how to take notes, how to write a paper, how to do research, but how to cope with stress, how to eat well. So it has physiological health information as well as the what you would expect in a how to do well in college book.
Well, chapter one, you say how to achieve your goals with metacognition. Metacognition, Gail, that's a 50-cent word.
I'm trying to remember.
You cover things like understanding your learning styles, making your brain work for you, identifying your personality types.
Right. Some people think that there aren't learning styles, so it's uncool to say that there are. But I definitely think that there are, that some people do learn better by hearing it. They're auditory, or they're kinesthetic. They need to write it out or diagram it or do something with blocks or something. So, yeah, I think we need to know how we best learn. And what I've found through years of studying is that the body has to be included. So I never read without underlining or taking notes, because I think we've all had that experience of reading and you think, what was that I just read? So if the body's involved, it's much more efficient. So my study strategy in college was to underline my lecture notes, underline my text notes, take notes on them, have index cards, and then I would know everything on those index cards and be able to apply it to test questions. So the repetition of taking notes, underlining, made me focus.
So you do have a chapter on study skills in your book, Your Mindful Guide to Academic Success, Beat Burnout. So you have a chapter on study skills where these tips that you were just passing along, things that you came up with when you were studying. And then you have a section, Overcoming Math Anxiety.
I haven't done it. But my dance teacher, John Piper, was a math major. And his point about math is that we use analytical, logical, A to B to C in thinking in our daily life. And so that it's good to appreciate math for how it enables to analyze and solve problems and think. But for me personally, I don't care about the hypotenuse, the 30-degree angle of
it. But if you were a carpenter, you might, Gail.
You're right.
And I think a lot of times people dismiss math. Well, I'm not going to need math. Once I get out of school, I'll never need math again. And they might be surprised.
Yes. No, that's true. I'm just not an expert in how to deal with math anxiety. You know, another thing that I think is really important about studying is whether we're homolateral or bilateral. And I think that's a very important concept. When we get homolateral, our body's aligned right side of the brain, right side of the body, left side of the brain, right side of the body. And the way it manifests when we're homolateral is we get fuzzy-brained, we can't think, we get klutzy. I know I drop glass, like drinking glass, and when that happens, okay, I need to balance. So a healthy body and a sharp mind is bilateral. So like if you have a stroke on the right side, it affects the left side of the body, and that's the way the balance should be. So the question is, if you're homolateral, how do you correct it? Very simple. You drink water and you cross crawl. So you touch like right elbow to left knee, left elbow to right knee, and it doesn't take very many cross crawls to correct.
So you have tips like this in your book on your guide to academic success.
Right. And I also teach them in my Mind Power workshop that I teach once a month. So people can learn about some of those balancing techniques. I teach how to center and how to ground and how to kind of protect your space, real practical visualizations to stay healthy.
Well, in this chapter on study skills, you have a section on effective oral reports. And I've heard it said that if you ask people, which would you rather do? Would you rather do public speaking or die? And most men would rather die than give a speech in public.
Right.
So how do people deal with that? What do you suggest for giving an effective oral report?
Well, I would start out with acupressure tapping, emotional freedom technique, some people have heard of. It's the best, those kind of energy psychologies are called, are an effective way to deal with irrational fears and beliefs and unresolved traumas. So first I would tap on it. And it's explained how to do it in my Essential Energy Tools book, or people can search for emotional freedom technique. So that's the first thing I would do. And then I would have bullets, but not read, because I think what's deadly in public speaking if someone reads their notes, because then they're looking down at their paper, it's not contact, bullets. And then
bullet points.
So you have to be you have to kind of elaborate from basic points that you want to make. And for some people, it helps them if they have a PowerPoint presentation, because then you could point to the slide and it takes the attention off of you. But I kind of don't like it if every place you go, every conference, every class is a PowerPoint with facts, because then the relationship is between the student and the screen, and we get enough screen time. So I if someone is really nervous, I would use some kind of visual aid and PowerPoint, but overall I think we use it too much.
So the title of this book, Your Mindful Guide to Academic Success, Beat Burnout, and you have several chapters, like one chapter about coping with stress, and that some of these tips you were just talking about, these physical exercises, I would think could also be considered a way of coping with stress.
Also the visualizations. Should we do a little grounding visualization?
Okay.
Okay. So what you do is you put your awareness on the base of your spine, and you imagine creating a taproot, like a big taproot on a giant redwood tree that goes down deep in the earth, and you make it wide as your hips, hollow. And so when you want to ground, you just think, breathe, send my taproot down, and you draw from the strength of the earth. And then you can also use it to release any stress and think, I'm flushing it down the taproot.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Gail, about your research and your study of global youth attitudes and activism.
Thank you, Nancy.
Gail Kimball has a trilogy of books. She travels around the world interviewing young people for her information, Global Youth Activism, Young Women. And we will look forward to, I know you've got more books coming out. So thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Gail Kimball, who has research focused on global youth attitudes and activism.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.